Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center for the Humanities at the University of Tulsa continues its year-long focus on humor this weekend with a lecture on how Woody Guthrie used humor to make his political points, as the center teams up with the Guthrie Archives to present Dr. Mark Allen Jackson, author of Prophet Singer, The Voice and Vision of Woody Guthrie, speaking on Guthrie as a political humorist. Jackson is an associate professor of English at Middle Tennessee State University who specializes in political expression in American music. He's published widely on both Guthrie and Bob Dylan's work, as well as American folk songs in general. He'll be speaking in a lecture Saturday evening at 7 at the Woody Guthrie Center, speaking on Woody Guthrie as a political humorist, his influences, expression, and legacy. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Professor Jackson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich.
Your interest in Woody Guthrie, as a professor of English, what originally interested you in the writings and songwriting of Woody Guthrie?
I think it's because I kind of came to Guthrie through Bob Dylan. So I was a Dylan fan, and I worked backwards. And I found Woody Guthrie. And part of the reason why I like Dylan is because he liked playing with language. So it wasn't just him as a musician, just him as a performer. It was him as a writer. And I enjoyed his political commentary. I enjoyed, you know, some humor that's built into some of his songs, which is sometimes hard to get because of the kind of complexity of the lyrics, I think. But his writing made me interested in how he kind of became the writer he was. And when I looked at his influences, I found Woody Guthrie, and I found somebody else who was not only an interesting musician and performer, but was also an interesting writer. And actually, that's kind of how Dylan got into him. He read his book, which is kind of an autobiographical novel called Bound to Glory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he got into his prose around the same time he got into his song. So he was interested in him as a writer, not, again, just as a musician.
You're going to be speaking about Guthrie's legacy as a political humorist. Was he thought of as a political humorist at all during his day? I mean, there was always a lot of humor in his songs from time to time. There were also, it was biting satire awful a lot of the time when he was using humor. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of times it would be this devastating look. You know, when you think of some of the songs about the coal mine disasters and union relations with management, there was no humor at all. It was deadly stuff.
Yeah. I was asked by Sean Latham over at the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities to do some work on Guthrie and his humor. And when I started looking through Guthrie's work, I kind of started just first flipping through some songbooks that I have, thinking about what would I say. And a lot of his songs are very serious. Some of the better-known ones, Pastures of Plenty, I Ain't Got No Home, there are a lot of hard realities in them. And so at first I thought, wow, he's more serious sometimes than I think, because I oftentimes have this idea of Guthrie as just kind of a funny, free-floating, funny guy. But sometimes when you look at his writing, you can see that kind of hard edge to him. But at the same time, he finds ways to kind of bring those two parts of himself together. And I would say that that's a big part of his writing, where he is funny, but he's funny for a purpose, and that purpose is to make a serious point. So the wit kind of wraps around that hard-edged truth, and I think it makes it easier for people to swallow, to experience, and I think that that's his impulse that makes him a political humorist. And some people see him that way as a satirist, but there's a lot of Guthries out there. There's not just one.
I know. I think that's one of the things you found when you really began working on Woody Guthrie, whether it's your book Prophet Singer, The Voice and Vision of Woody Guthrie, or I think you've written a number of papers on him, that I think there is a singular image of Woody Guthrie that's out there, but in fact, there's probably a whole lot of different Woodies.
He's a somewhat well-known writer of children's songs. There are a number of people who have recorded them, and he recorded them too in his lifetime. They're just a bunch of fun. There's not really much political commentary in them, I would say. It's just about kind of coming at the world from a child's perspective. And so they're, you know, one is Let's Go Ride in the Car, and he makes car noises and honking noises as part of that. And so that kind of childlike quality that I think you can see in him in general kind of comes out very strongly there. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, he has songs about, say, deportees, which, you know, I think is relevant today as it was in his time, about how immigrants are treated, especially those who come here illegally but who still work in the fields and are engaged in the production of agricultural products that everybody enjoys and needs, but that are treated as subhuman. And so he saw a piece in the New York Times about a plane wreck, and the group of people who died in it, they were just called deportees because they were being deported. And so he gives them a name and he gives them a story in the song, and that's a very serious topic. But at the same time, he's someone who can write those children songs, which aren't political, but they're just about fun and about what it's like to be a child from a child's perspective. So that's a pretty big spectrum there between that song and Let's Go Riding in the Car Car.
And it sounds like there was a pretty early evolution in his viewpoints, but his views evolved fairly soon after leaving Oklahoma and moving to California, where he has songs that are not that sort of spirit we think of Woody Guthrie, of always championing the underdog, the refugee, the union worker. There's some songs that sort of don't take that viewpoint.
Well, that's true. I think when Guthrie was living in Texas, so he was born in Oklahoma,
right,
but he moves to Texas kind of as a teenager, and so he kind of comes into adulthood there. And he's living in, you know, he'd been living in small-town Oklahoma. He'd been living in small-town Texas during the 1920s and the early 1930s.
Dust Bowl years, yeah.
Yeah, and during that time period, I don't think he was overly politically active. When I look at the writing that comes out of there, and there's not a lot from that time period. There's a lot more from later. But he's just mainly interested in playing music and having a good time. And then he travels to California because there aren't very many opportunities in Pampa, Texas. It's a Great Depression. It's the era, as you mentioned, of the Dust Bowl when about a 10-year drought hits the area, and so it destroys agriculture, and that's a big part of the panhandle area of Texas in that time period. And so there isn't much to do there, even if you want to be a musician. So he travels with, as a lot of people did, to California. Now, during the travels, he experienced a lot of hardships, which seems to me got him to thinking about kind of the big political issues of his day, but that didn't immediately change him and suddenly he becomes a political activist. He evolves. It's a slow process, and he did, when he was in California, write some material that offers up racist commentary that is not overly enthusiastic about a leftist political position, but he soon started moving in that direction, I think in part because of the prejudice that he encountered.
Yeah, if you're from the middle part of the country, you were an Okie in California.
And Okies were treated as a lot of minority groups.
And Okie was a horrible pejorative. We have to always remember, for people who think of Okie from Muskogee as a badge of honor, those were fighting words for the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, people called Okie and Arky. You know, I mean, that you were just seen as someone who wasn't important. In fact, he got through a song called Dust Bowl Refugee, so he suddenly sees those people at some point as being kind of ejected from their place and not having a home, not having a place, being seen as second-class citizens. And because of some people he was hanging out with, like Will Gear, who was played Grandpa on The Waltons.
Yes, right.
He was a big leftist, which I don't think people always remember.
He was blacklisted, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah. He got in a lot of trouble in the 50s. He was blacklisted, and people wouldn't work with him. But by the time the Waltons rolled around, that had been kind of forgotten to some degree. And he plays a cantankerous old guy. You know, I mean,
right.
There isn't a political position on the Waltons. I mean, I guess there is some in a way, but it's certainly not Will Gear's typical political position, where he was seen as kind of a very radical person. So Guthrie hangs out with him, and he starts encouraging him to think in certain ways. He starts having him read like the Daily Worker, the communist newspaper. They start spending time with a lot of people who want to say something about the American political system of the 30s and the hardships that were going on and how that came about. And Guthrie decided that he agreed with that, and he decided that, you know, dismissing someone because of their race or because of the hardships in their life, that was wrong. And he even writes some songs, letters, pieces in his diary in which he apologizes for those earlier positions. And I a lot of times people think, well, that's waffling, that you change your mind. For me, that's a badge of honor. When you have had a position and then you start thinking about it and you start challenging it and you find that there's a flaw in that way of thinking that you had before and that you're willing to see a new path, one that's more inclusive, one that I think has a more positive spirit, and you move towards that, I mean, that to me is something to be celebrated rather than kind of condemned as he changed his mind, that's a negative, that he doesn't know his own mind. He changed his mind, and he had reason for doing that. And then after that, he tried to stay on that path. But he's a human being, and we all sometimes can let our baser voice, the one that listens to kind of prejudices, that listens to stereotypes, kind of lead us in certain directions and not the best impulses. And he heard those early on, but he also later heard other voices, more positive, light-filled voices, and then he listened to them.
And he seemed to, when that evolution came about, and was the Woody Guthrie that we know and remember today, you know, when you look at some of his songs, some are very pointed commentary, some have this satirical view to them, but it's also, you know, and you have to remember the times. This was the 1930s, and a lot of people were hanging on by a thin string, and so his targets were all sorts of moneyed interest, political power, economic power. And some of his targets sometimes were surprising people, like Fiorello LaGuardia, who's sort of also thought to be a champion of the little man. If he saw something he didn't like what LaGuardia was doing, he was writing pretty furious prose or poetry or songs about a person like that.
Yeah. Oh, he didn't like Franklin Delano Roosevelt so much during the late 1930s.
Was it because he thought he wasn't doing enough?
Oh, yeah, Well, I mean, at that point, in the late 1930s, Roosevelt had, you know, about 6-7 years to straighten things out. And it's not really fair, I guess, in a way to say, oh, gosh, this a single human being, even though that person is the president, has the power to change everything. But he's the figurehead. And so Guthrie looks around at that time period and thinks Roosevelt hasn't made enough change because there were a lot of people still living in poverty, or there were a lot of people who, as the phrase is now, underemployed. And so he thought that there had been forces at play that kept Roosevelt from making changes, or maybe even kept Roosevelt from wanting to make changes. So Guthrie pointed to Wall Street. He pointed to the political process as a whole, and he thought that in a way that Roosevelt had kind of capitulated to those forces and had listened to them. He also didn't like Roosevelt's kind of attitude towards the Soviet Union. And that anti-communist kind of hysteria starts, you know, a long time before Guthrie comments on it, but it permeates the American culture. It's floating around. It's bubbling up here and there. And Roosevelt had a hesitancy, as did a lot of people, about what kind of a relationship would they have with the Soviet Union. Guthrie, since he'd gotten to be friends with a lot of people who were very pro, you know, communist ideology, he was pro-Soviet Union. He thought that they were going to do something good. Now, later, a lot of people realized what Stalin was doing, what other members of the Soviet hierarchy were doing to the people, and then rejected that. But at that moment, Guthrie thought that the Soviet Union was a workers' paradise, that it was pro-everyman. And he thought that Roosevelt had said he was going to be pro-everyman, but that he had not quite lived up to that. So he attacked Roosevelt. Now, however, after World War II kicks on, Guthrie's position changes because he's very anti-Nazi. He despises the Nazi because they're anti-people. And so when Roosevelt goes anti-Nazi, Guthrie is completely and totally behind him.
Of course, we know the guitar, this machine kills fascists.
Yes. He was in the Army. He was drafted.
Yep.
He was in the Merchant Marine. That's a risky position because they're taking supplies over to Europe. And actually, two ships he was on were torpedoed. So Guthrie was in the war effort in a variety of ways, even though he was not on the front lines. He was in support of the pushback against Hitler and thus, you know, that his support for Roosevelt. But he even later, when Roosevelt was, you know, talking about, well, let's not have strikes during the war, Guthrie was against that. So even though he was pro-Roosevelt in terms of being anti-Nazi, he could still take swipes at Roosevelt for not supporting labor enough. So Guthrie decided at each moment, I'm going to support or not support someone on this particular position. So it wasn't like he fell in love with any one person and it always said that they were wonderful. He would look at different attitudes, different policies that, you know, public figures would put forward, and he would decide whether he was in support of that or not. So he could be kind of a curmudgeon in a way. He was not someone who would immediately jump on just necessarily one bandwagon and follow it.
My guest today is Dr. Mark Allen Jackson, an associate professor of English at the Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of Prophet Singer, The Voice and Vision of Woody Guthrie. He'll be speaking at an event at the Woody Guthrie Center, sponsored by them and the Oklahoma Center for Humanities at the University of Tulsa, this Saturday evening at 7 o'clock on Woody Guthrie as Political Humorist. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, when you look at, you know, one of the things when you go to the archives now, you see all the varied output. And as you've been looking at Guthrie's material over the years, when you see what appear to be song lyrics or sometimes maybe they're poetry, you know, the artwork has been a revelation to a lot of people to see all the cartoons that he would do. And really the cartoons are, I think, perhaps where you see maybe his greatest legacy as a political humorist. The cartoons were genuinely political cartoons in a lot of senses.
Yeah. Guthrie actually wrote a column for the Daily Worker and then also the People's World, which is kind of the West Coast version of the East Coast Daily Worker. He had a column called Woody Says, and it was in honor of Will Rogers' daily column.
Right.
And along with the essays that he would turn in, he would turn in little drawings with many of them. So he kind of saw himself as a political cartoonist in a way, and also a political humorist in terms of his writing. So many of those pieces that he wrote for the paper were funny, even though they were about serious subjects, and sometimes they were just serious. It depended, I suspect, like any columnist, on your mood when you're writing. But we can see a lot of those kinds of cartoons you probably had encountered at the Woody Guthrie Center and in some books that have come out that include Guthrie's drawing along with his writing. And he does a lot of drawings that aren't political, but he has tons that are, some which are funny, some which are super serious drawings. The one that kind of most affected me in terms of him as a, I wouldn't even say a cartoonist, as a visual artist, was this kind of ghostly bridge which arches up like a cat's back across this chasm, and underneath are all these lynched bodies hanging there.
Mm, yeah.
And it just strikes you because it's not just one, it's many. And that really is kind of drawn from a reality that occurred near Okemo, Oklahoma. This woman and her son were taken from the jail and hung because there had been an altercation with a peace officer had come out to the home. He ended up getting shot. It was supposedly an accident. The family as a whole was taken into custody, but a mob comes, drags the mother and the oldest boy from the jail and takes them to a bridge and hangs them. Now, there was actually a postcard. There was a photograph taken of the bodies hanging from the bridge, and it was made into a postcard, which is, strangely enough, kind of a typical happening in America in the early part of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah. There was a long political debate over whether there would be a federal anti-lynching law in the 1930s and 40s.
There was, and Roosevelt really didn't want to support it because he was afraid he would lose Southern senators, and that was one thing that, again, made Guthrie angry about Roosevelt. So Guthrie is very anti-lynching, and we see that in this drawing. So, again, I don't want to call it a cartoon because a cartoon suggests a certain tone. And this is a serious drawing, but Guthrie wanted to say something about the political reality of America, not only in his songs, not only in his column, but also in the drawings that he made.
You know, as you look at Woody Guthrie's influence today, he certainly has influence. You see all sorts of major American music artists singing his songs. In large part, that is due to the times we're in. It's a large part also due to the efforts of the Guthrie family to keep his music alive as well. But when you look at this varied output, whether it be those columns in the Western Worker, whether it be the cartoons or the drawings or his prose work, how well does it hold up? I mean, we have this interesting parallel times. We have the what they we're calling the Great Recession, which is another, it's been another depression, frankly, since 2008. You have the same times. You see some of these same political currents that were alive and well in the 1930s, alive today. So how well does his work speak to a contemporary audience today?
I think if you look at all the people who've kind of picked up his song lyrics and performed them, Annie DeFranco, Billy Bragg, Bruce Springsteen, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Lots of people perform Guthrie's music, and I don't think that they do that for the most part out of any sort of nostalgic impulse. I think they do it because that they find a truth in his writing. Guthrie himself, in thinking about writing, and I can't remember this, I think it was in a letter to the Almanac Singers when he was on the West Coast and they had just formed Pete Seeger's in it, Lee Hayes, and several other people, and he was writing to them about how they should write songs, and he said, what you need to do is include some timeless element in it. And so he wanted to speak not just to his moment, but he wanted to speak to issues that he felt kind of that were larger than just the time period in which he was living, that kind of spoke to a reality that I suspect that he saw had happened in the past in history, and that he also thought that would probably still be relevant in the future. So it seems to me that he actually wanted to write at least some work that would linger on beyond his life and that lingered on beyond the issues of his own era. And I think we can see that in the work that people pick up and perform. If you look at his songs, look at his prose writing, he talks about Wall Street. He talks about what happens on Wall Street. There's one kind of moment. He says all they have to do is have a little sneeze or a cough and the whole nation gets sick. And so he knew, right, because he got to see that when the great crash happened at the very end of the 1920s, that America had gotten off track economically, that everybody wasn't involved in the growth, that only some people were, including those who were involved in buying stocks and bonds, right, who were in the financial industry. And he saw that when that's not kind of taken care of, that small number of people, relatively small number of people, if they mess up, it just doesn't hurt them, it hurts everybody. And so we got to experience that in our own era in 2008, and we still feel that. And so the Great Depression, you know, kind of is generally seen as beginning in the late 1920s, though it really kind of starts after World War One. It starts building up, that demand for war products, et cetera, that drops off. And industry really doesn't respond well to that, and then their speculation occurs. And then suddenly the economy falls apart, and it doesn't recover again until World War II brings us out of our economic doldrums. And that's because we're making things, and the rest of the world gets bombed out. And so we were left after World War II with lots of production because nobody else had any. And in 2008, we get to see kind of that there was this kind of bloated, you know, housing market, that there was this kind of belief in credit, and it fell apart. So in that we look back and we see that there was basically a decade of kind of depression, or even we could say even maybe a little bit longer than that, we're kind of feeling the same thing. Things fell apart for us, and we're still feeling that pinch. Later, Guthrie had that same experience. And so I think that he is especially apt at speaking to a situation like we're in now because he was in one. Very similar. It wasn't the same.
Yeah.
It was much worse then. There was 25% or more unemployment, some places much higher than that. There was a lot more devastation. There was a drought. I mean, we've had a drought. California has had a drought. And the Great Plains always has droughts, some bigger than others, but that was a super drought. Then, along with giant economic devastation, so I'm not trying to say that they're equal. We have it easier, I would say, but I'm not sure everybody feels that way. But Guthrie's talking about that same kind of pain, that you lose your house, that you lose your job, that you lose potentially some level of your dignity, and then how do you respond to that? What do you do? Do you just fall apart? And I think a lot of his songs says, no, we're not going to fall apart. You know, he says it's hard, but he says we're going to overcome eventually. So there's a message about the wrong, but there's also a message that says that wrong will not defeat us.
My guest today is Dr. Mark Allen Jackson, Associate Professor of English at Middle Tennessee State. He'll be speaking Saturday evening at 7 o'clock at the Woody Guthrie Center on Woody Guthrie as Political Humorist. Now, you mentioned at the top that, your entrance into Woody Guthrie was Bob Dylan. Well, I have to ask you, since you mentioned that, we have the Woody Guthrie archives coming to Tulsa. We're going to have the Bob Dylan archives coming to Tulsa. As a scholar of political expression in American music, what is this going to mean to you, having these two repositories literally in the same block here within a year or so?
I think it's a very exciting development. I'm going to talk about Bob Dylan a little bit on Saturday, because Dylan was very much influenced by Guthrie as a whole, but also I think in his kind of political humor. Having Dylan's work there along with Guthrie's, that's going to be great for discussing connections between them, but just, looking at Dylan's work itself, his notes, his pieces that he's decided to give, I'm not really sure what it all is. I've read some articles on it, and they kind of mention, like, oh, here's a song lyric, and you can see his coffee cup ring on it. And I'm like, well, as a scholar, I'm not really sure that's going to be helpful. But sometimes I think what it is, some little piece like that, it gives you a sense of the humanness of the person. And so when I've looked at Guthrie's work, it's not so much that I find every page offers me something that I want to make a comment on, but each page gives me a sense of him as a person, because I see his handwriting, I see the little drawings he includes. Sometimes they're small, sometimes they're big, sometimes there's whole pages. And those kinds of things are helpful, because sometimes we forget the person and we get caught up in the arguments we want to make, or we get caught up in loving the music or the songs, and we forget that somebody had to sit down and make this. And if we can better understand that person and how they came to make it, I think we better understand what they eventually did make.
Well, we're out of time. Mark Jackson, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Mark Allen Jackson is an associate professor of English at Middle Tennessee State and an expert on political expression in American music. He's the author of Prophet Singer, The Voice and Vision of Woody Guthrie. He'll be speaking Saturday evening at 7 o'clock at the Woody Guthrie Center in a co-sponsored event by the Oklahoma Center for the Humanities on Woody Guthrie as Political Humorist, His Influences, Expression, and Legacy. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.